You and Matt are the same. You both write like 7 books a year. So I can imagine it's hard to remember what.
I did not write all 4 books that came out last year, the year before. I can explain when those got written, but maybe that could be a question for the podcast.
Yeah, sure.
Absolutely. Yeah.
Welcome to the Fascinating Podcast, your home for Eldritch Horror. I'm Matt Michalotis.
And I can never remember, do I go next? Yeah, okay, I'm Jared Forresteros, and it's just the two of us today. That's because we are recording at a special time because we have a special guest, but more about that later. Matt,
yes.
We are about to interview a famous scientist
yes.
who is also an author.
Yes.
And so I wanted to test your animal knowledge.
I love animals.
I found a really fun Twitter thread written by a medievalist about weird things medieval people believed about animals.
Okay.
Okay. So I'm going to ask you why animals do certain things, and you're going to try to guess the answer based on what medievalists believe.
All right. So this is bestiary stuff.
Yep. Why do hedgehogs have spines?
For getting food.
Yeah, actually, it's to carry fruit back to their dens.
That's right. They put
it
on the spines.
They stuck the fruit on the ends of the spines.
Yeah, and they walk it on. That's right.
Okay. Why do mother bears lick their young?
I know this one.
You know this one?
I do. It's okay. They're born shapeless, and the bears have to lick them into shape.
I can't believe you know that. You're so weird. I love it. why do foxes roll... why are foxes red?
Are foxes red? To hide among the fall leaves.
Okay, you're close. They actually are red because they roll in red mud.
Oh.
Because it mimics blood, which allows them to trick birds into thinking that they're dead.
Oh, that's clever. I would never have thought of that. Mm-hmm. Well done, foxes.
Yep. Here's another one that actually weirdly relates to the beginning of our conversation with Preemie.
Uh-oh.
How will a beaver defend itself if it is pursued by a hunting party?
How will a beaver defend? I'm really concerned about how this might connect to what Preemie told us. By impregnating a dog.
No, it chews off its own testicles and leaves them behind.
Oh, apparently, to give the dog something to eat.
I guess?
Come
it's
on,
unclear.
Beavers.
It's unclear why they thought that would work.
Well, maybe it worked once and they were just like, well, keep trying.
I'm going to throw this one out there and we got to talk about it for a second.
All right.
There is a myth that lion cubs were born dead, but then come to life when after 3 days their fathers breathe on them.
There's a lot of medievalist bestiary stuff that is directly Christian. So there's, what is it? Is it storks? There's some bird that they prick their own breast to get blood to come out to like help their baby birds live or something.
That's gotta be an Aslan thing then too, right?
It could be.
You're the C.S. Lewis expert on the show.
I mean, He's definitely a medievalist. He would have known that for sure.
And I'm fascinated.
There's a lot of Aslan breathing on things, too.
Yeah. Yeah. There you go. There you go, folks. All right. You heard it here. Well, we have a great interview with our new friend, Preemie, today. Preemie Mohammed is a Nebula Award-winning Indo-Caribbean scientist and speculative fiction author.
Amazing.
Who's based in Edmonton, Alberta. So she's Canadian. Explains why she's so kind. She's an assistant editor at the short fiction audio venue Escape Pod, and she is the author of the Beneath the Rising series of novels, as well as several novellas. Her short fiction has appeared in a lot of venues, and she is on Twitter at Preemiesaurus. She'll tell you that at the end as well. And this was just a delightful interview. She is someone that we could eat. I feel like most of the guests we've had on in the last 5 or 6 episodes are people we could just like... do entire seasons just talking about.
Absolutely. I mean, Preemie could be a guest host anytime. She's really fun.
So even though it's just the two of us, I know that you will enjoy our interview with Preemie Mohammed. So let's hop over there. We are here with author Preemie Mohammed. Preemie, welcome to the podcast. It is such an honor to have you with us.
Thank you so much for inviting me.
So we always ask our first-time guests, what is something that fascinates you, you know, like generally in life?
Generally, the big thing that fascinates me is nature. And of course, that's a big answer, but I'm the one who's always busting out the bizarre animal facts at parties. Back when we used to have parties, I don't know if you guys remember
that. I remember that vaguely.
I love bizarre animal facts. Can you bust one out?
Here's the one that I busted out today in Mer's live stream, which is that there is a cute small furry creature called the Antechinus that basically boinks itself to death. And I'm sure evolution had a super, super good idea when it was coming up with that. But basically, the males either, when it's mating season, the males either spend all their time mating and they don't eat or defending their right to mate.
You gotta hydrate.
And then eventually they starve, they dehydrate, and they die.
No.
Reliably every time. And I saw the saddest article the other day that was something like scientists working to preserve species that reproduces itself to death. And people are like, oh, what an interesting premise. I'm like, that doesn't mean what you think it means. It means they are humping to death.
Yeah.
They are tired.
Oh, wow. Yeah, no.
Do they produce big litters?
Yeah.
Okay.
Oh, it's very much the strategy of like, you know, well, let's just make lots of babies. And really, when you get right down to it, most species only need so many males.
Yeah, we are pretty expendable.
It's a good
point. I feel bad for them, though. They're so cute.
Well, yeah, there you go. I mean,
and this is why I don't get invited to parties anymore, among other things.
Are you joking? That's great party talk.
Yeah, you'd be the queen of our parties here.
That's way better than are these Doritos or spicy Doritos?
Oh, look at Mr. Fancy getting invited to parties with Doritos.
Yeah, right.
Yeah, well, Portland, you know.
So according to your website, you're both an author and an eldritch monster. Mm. So are we your dream or are you awakened?
Mm.
I unfortunately can't tell you that because it would end the dream.
Okay, yeah, it would drive us insane. And okay,
Yeah.
Oh, man. That's funny. Preemie, JR is a gigantic horror fan. He loves horror so much.
That's why I bought
so
her book.
Much. Yeah. Yeah. He sees every movie. He reads all the horror books. How did your love for horror begin? What was it like JR where you were exposed to something horrific as a child and you were like, that's fun? Or what was it for
kind
you?
Kind of. It must have been. You know, the thing is, I didn't think that I wrote a horror book. I thought I wrote an adventure book, particularly with Beneath the Rising. Well, because, you know, they're like moving around different countries. They're kind of, I was like, well, this is like Indiana Jones, but with kids. And then before it came out, I started seeing it appear on, here's some upcoming horror for March. And I'd be like, upcoming what? So I'm emailing my editor. I'm like, did I write a horror novel? He's like, I'm putting you in for all the horror awards.
That's
I
awesome.
Was scared editing this. And I was like, how could you?
That's awesome.
So I don't actually consume a ton of horror media. I'm afraid of horror movies.
Me too.
I rarely watch horror movies.
All right.
They scare me. I just finished reading Ghost Stories of an Antiquary and More Ghost Stories of an Antiquary, which is a terrible title, by M.R. James. And I debated sleeping with the lights on. These are old stories. They should not be scary. I was scared.
I went to JR's house and watched a movie called The Witch, and I was staying the night at his place. And went into the guest room and I was like, I'm afraid of goats now. Like,
yeah.
What if there's a goat in this house?
I watched Hannibal at a friend's recommendation and I ended up scared of like everything except like distilled water and Triscuits. Like I didn't even want to eat. I was afraid of food.
Yeah. The most predictable, like mono substance thing that you can get, right?
Triscuits. Yeah. But yeah, I don't know. I haven't read a ton of horror. I guess I've read the usual handful of Stephen King. I've read a lot of Lovecraft and Robert Howard and Edgar Allan Poe and Arthur Machen, who was, as far as I can tell, completely bonkers, and Lord Dunsany. And a lot of the kind of the folk horror stuff, I'm really interested in that. and stuff sort of adjacent to folk horror, or stuff where people didn't realize that they were writing folk horror because as a term, it didn't really become a thing until sort of like the 60s, 70s. So I guess it really never started, and I didn't think I was writing horror. I never thought I was writing a scary book. I wanted the characters to be afraid. And then I had people emailing me like, oh, you know, there was a scene early on in the book and now I'm sleeping with the lights on. I'm like, oh, I don't remember that. I'm sorry.
Creamy,
I apologize.
For our audience at home, what's the basic idea of the Void series? Like, don't give us spoilers or whatever, but what would you put on the back of the book or whatever?
I don't remember what they put on the back of the book.
Well,
but,
what would you put on the back of the book?
I would steal what somebody summarized it as at Worldcon 2019. I wish I'd gotten the guy's name because it was just like almost a hit and run. He just came and chatted about the book for a couple of minutes with a few people and then he left. He said, a scientist solves the world's energy problem and creates several other problems. JR's laughing. Am I wrong?
No, I think that's what's so fun, which, I mean, we're going to get into all this in a minute, but yeah, I mean, it's very much that sort of like, be careful what you wish for sort of, which again, I think that's very much a classic horror trope, right? It's like, yeah, you get the thing that you wanted and then it turns out the monkey's paw thing, right?
There's
it
a
turns
price.
Out to be a,
yeah.
Yeah, and so there is the them, which I love that you write it, you know, with the capital T. You have to say it that way too, right?
They hear it in the book. They hear the them.
Yeah.
This also, I think, to me, also made it kind of a classic sci-fi as well, because the basic premise of so much sci-fi, especially classic sci-fi, is scientist has wonderful idea, and unintended consequences appear. Mm-hmm. Or technology is developed that is supposed to be wonderful, but it's not wonderful for everyone. Or setting is supposed to be excellent, but actually it's terrible. Just all the things that scientists or experts or educated people or politicians or local geniuses think that they probably should have foreseen and they don't. And then you've got a sci-fi book. So it's kind of sci-fi, fantasy, horror, adventure. Mm.
Yeah,
it is
a really, and I mean this in the best way, it's a really weird blend of genres that totally works. Like when you said Indiana Jones earlier, I was like, yeah, actually, yes, especially the final act of the first book is so, so Indiana Jonesy and cosmic horror. mm-hmm. And it's a really... I don't know. It's really clever and it feels fresh in a way that, not that I don't know that the cosmic horror genre is tapped out yet, but even still, this series feels just really unique in a way that I really enjoyed.
Thank you. Yeah, kind of Indiana Jones and the reaching tentacles or whatever.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, if they were going to title it, and if Harrison Ford wasn't just like sick to death of all this.
You know, Indiana Jones 5, they just released the first look.
They just released, yeah, exactly.
Yeah. Spielberg, if you're listening.
How old is that dude? Yeah, he's...
70s, right?
I think he's in his 80s now.
I think he's in his 80s.
Well,
yeah.
Somebody's got it.
Good for him. I mean, whatever.
Good for him, yeah. But yeah, again, these are also movies that the kids would have been familiar with in the book.
Right.
Because, you know, they were born in the 80s. It's set in 2002, the first book. So, yeah.
So a couple things about the world building that I think we can do without really doing too many spoilers. First of all, I'm really curious. There's some, even at the end of the first book, which we should also say, all three books are out now. You can enjoy all three of them and you should, but we're trying not to spoil everything. So we're going to tread ever more lightly the further we get into the series. But even in the first book, there's some big reveals, particularly about your scientist character, Johnny. How early did you know those things were true about her?
Pretty early in the writing. Yeah. I wanted it to be a case of, this is not a, this is going to sound really bad. This is not a real prodigy. This is a fake prodigy. This is a chosen one who has taken steps to be a chosen one and to knock other potential chosen ones out of the running and to arrange everything in her life to ensure that A, she stays a chosen one, and B, it stays a secret.
Wait, is she a bad guy? Oh, don't tell me.
It's complicated, complicated, Matt.
I mean, it just sounds so much like Elon Musk.
And no? about Joni is if she probably would stand some comparisons to Elon Musk, but her big thing is she wants to save the world and to be seen saving the world. But in the books, she's actually doing it. She's had technologies in place for years to help, you know, marginalized populations like cheap solar. She's got a team that responds to natural disasters.
Yeah.
She helps with unhoused people, malnutrition, things like that. She's cured as many diseases as she's had time for so far. She's on the way, and I think the second book, to cure guinea worm. And Nick is like, what the hell is guinea worm? She's like, you don't want it.
So, well, I mean, so she's full of herself, but with good reason, it sounds like.
Yeah, she wants to be a hero.
Yeah, go get it.
Yeah.
That was the other thing I wanted to ask, just purely in terms of world building. Like, for instance, this is a world where 9/11 did not happen.
Mm-hmm.
Because largely of Johnny's presence and her innovations and,
oh, wow,
and these sorts of things. So in building out a world that is, you know, recognizably our world, but also what I like about this is it's the opposite of the Marvel effect, right? Mm-hmm. Where in the Marvel comics and cinematic universe, you have people like a Reed Richards and a Tony Stark who allegedly are creating these like world changing, brilliant inventions once a week. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, the world is largely still exactly the same as ours.
Mm-hmm.
And you don't do that, right? You say, if there was really this world-changing genius who's been around since the mid-80s, our world would look dramatically different, mm-hmm, and yet still recognizable. Like, how hard was that for you to get into that? Or is that such something you were having fun with?
It was something that I wanted to kind of keep an eye on, particularly because when the first book was written, I was just an undergrad. I was writing for fun because I wrote everything for fun. Nobody ever read any of my stuff. So the world building was literally just for me. And it wasn't really until I was kind of cleaning it up to, you know, to query with, to try to get literary representation with, that I was like, okay, I'm going to try to make sure that some of the knock-on effects of having an actual working genius in the world would happen. So for instance, in the first book, when they go to Morocco, one thing that Nick notices is that several of the houses have Johnny's solar tiles on them for electricity in various patterns, like a sunburst or like a chicken or whatever. And he's like, oh, cute. Like, oh, and then, oh my God, they really are everywhere. They're everywhere in the world. Everybody has this.
Hmm.
Like, so, you know, the entire world is electrified. It's already trying to get off fossil fuels, stuff like that. The big world change in the first one, I had to think about some of the knock-on effects for that. And so Nick immediately comes up with a list. He's like, oh, this is going to change. This is going to change. This is going to change. Wow, what an exciting, interesting world it's going to be. And then, of course, in the second book, he asks a question that he probably should have asked in the first book. It doesn't get answered, but it does get answered in the third. So, and yeah, it wasn't this multiverse effect. So the first book was written, I don't know, I finished it in about 2002. So roughly when it was set, and around the time that I was graduating. And, you know, I didn't read a whole ton of comics. I have my, you know, my stack of the ones from the local used bookstore because they were 25 cents each. So you just kind of go through and grab whatever looked interesting.
Nice.
And of course, they were never in order. But you could go in there with $5 and come out with a huge stack of comics.
Yeah.
So, you know, the idea of like a multiverse or something, I was like, obviously, I'm not the first person to do it, but I would like to figure out a way that it works both with the science and with the magic.
Oh.
And I didn't have to think about how it would work for sequels because, you know, it was one book. I didn't want it to get published or anything. I thought, I'm never going to be a writer, so I don't have to care. This is just something I can sort of take out now and then, tinker with and put away. And then when Solaris bought it, they bought two books and I was like, oh, sequel. how do you write a sequel? It generally says you should have figured out what you were going to write in the sequel before you wrote the first book. And I was like, that does not help me. I just sold the first book.
Oh no. That's hilarious. Wow.
Let's talk a little bit about the science magic thing. Because you mentioned you are a scientist when you're not writing books. So I'm even more excited to ask this. But in my experience, and you two, both fantasy and sci-fi authors, correct me if I'm wrong, seems like when it comes to fantasy, there's kind of like two kinds of magic systems. There's like the supernatural and the natural. What I mean by that is, you know, the supernatural is, yeah, it's this other force. It comes from somewhere else. There's not really rules to it. You have to just be trained in it or get it from, you know, a god or some kind of other higher power or whatever. So that would be like, you know, Dungeons and Dragons, Lord of the Rings, Game of Thrones, that kind of stuff. The natural one is more like, no, magic is just this other kind of force that exists in this, you know, universe, and you, there are rules that it follows. There are patterns that it has. You can innovate with it if you understand. So it'd be like, you know, the weaving in Wheel of Time or Brandon Sanderson's Cosmere, like all the different magic systems he has there. And in this series, you very much, I mean, you explicitly call whatever they are using magic, right? And then on the flip side, you have this prodigy genius inventor who is very much a scientific genius. So when did that become kind of the framework for your book?
Again, kind of pretty early in the book.
Okay.
Because I knew that I knew that I wanted there to be kind of that push and pull there too. And for Johnny specifically to be like, okay, well, it's magic if we don't understand it, but if I can understand and control it, then it becomes science. Unfortunately, what keeps happening is it stubbornly continues to be magic.
Yeah.
she has kind of got the right idea though, which is that, you know, it is, it's something that some people can use and some people can't use. And it's something where the ability to use it can be given to you, but you can also get it by accident.
Oh,
so,
man.
Like Nick in the second book, who's able to use magic basically by proximity effects. And he's like, what the hell are proximity effects? I didn't ask for this. But Nick has a really hard time with things in the books. I apologize for that, Nick. But, you know, basically she's looking at it almost like electricity. So it's like you go from rubbing the piece of amber on the piece of fur and seeing sparks to eventually, you know, smartphones. And she's like, if I can figure out how to channel magic or say amplify magic or collect it or increase it, then that's only, you know, that's one other thing that I could be a hero at or about. And again, this backfires hugely because magic isn't as, she's thinking of magic in kind of terms of like quantum particles almost, like photons or muons or baryons. Instead, they're just kind of out there doing whatever. And she's like, they should not be out there doing whatever. They have to operate by some kind of rules. Whereas, again, magic's like, whee! So that's, it's almost another antagonist in the book.
Yeah.
It's something
absolutely.
She wants to control or defeat. And instead, it controls and defeats her fairly frequently.
Wow. Sounds really fun. You just, is this right? You just had a launch party for the final book in the trilogy.
Yeah, that was really fun. It was, you know, tiny cause there's a plague, but, I was gratified that people showed up like at all. And I signed a ton of books.
Oh, that's fun. What was that your first, you've done launch parties for the other two also, or was.
No, we managed to do a tiny, tiny one for the first one. But that was like mid March, 2020.
Oh,
so it was already a case of like, my friend Dave texted me right beforehand and he was like, I absolutely do not want to sound paranoid about this, but both of us are coughing really bad and we don't want to come.
Yeah.
So
this was your first,
stay home.
This was your first ever like book launch then, really, in some sense.
Yeah, and like a handful of people came and we all kind of like looked nervously at each other in case somebody had the plague. So yeah, my entire publishing career so far has been during the pandemic, 6 books.
Wow, preemie, that's amazing.
The entire thing. I'm so,
congratulations.
So sick of the plague. Thank you.
Tell us a little bit about that process. What? So you wrote the first book in the Void series, and is that what opened the door to getting representation and you? Your agent went right out and sold it, like.
Kinda. I don't think right out and sold it is the right phrase.
I mean, this is a common issue with geniuses. I can tell that you're, you know, digging into your own life for some of the book here.
Quote unquote. Yeah. If only I had millions of dollars. But
it'll come in time.
No, that one. I decided to query with Beneath the Rising because it was done.
Yeah.
Not because I thought it was my best work or anything,
yeah,
but because I have so many novels sitting around that were just, you know, because it's my hobby.
Right.
I just kind of noodled and noodled and noodled and noodled. And I think in other interviews, the analogy I've used is, you know, like your dad has like this car sitting in like out back, and every now and then he goes out and tinkers with it, but he doesn't actually fix it till it's drivable.
Right.
He just goes out and tinkers with it.
Right.
Or he buys some paint or something and then he comes back. So that was like all my writing. It was just my hobby.
Yeah.
And so yeah, when I started selling short stories and people started like nudging me, but okay, that looks like they're giving me the people's elbow, but they weren't. When people started nudging me and not doing wrestling moves on me to sell a novel, I kind of looked through my files and I was like, hey, this one has a the end on it.
Yeah.
So I gave it a light polish. It wasn't as bad as I thought it would have been for being written by a 20-year-old, and wrote a query letter and sent it out the door. And my agent did offer representation right away. He loved it.
That's great.
And then it went out on sub and we got some wonderful rejections back.
Oof.
Like, oh, we love this, but we don't know where to shelf it. I'm like, that sounds very much like a you problem, not a me problem. My agent was like, I am not forwarding that. I'm like, okay. But stuff like, they're like, well, it's, you know, is it fantasy or sci-fi? I'm like, yes. Well, okay. Then is it fantasy, sci-fi, or horror?
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Which do you want?
Which do you want? And they were like, well, the marketing team is going to throw up their hands and the acquisitions committee won't let us. And then we went to Solaris and they were like, hey, no, we love it. That's we're going to awesome. Buy two of them. I was like, there aren't two of it. They're like, that means.
They're like, there will be.
It's a duology and you write a sequel. I'm like, oh, sequel. I can do that.
See, you asked for one book and you didn't know what you were getting into. It just
So then I have to figure out how to write a sequel. I'd never written a sequel before. So
wait, is this the end then? Is it just a trilogy or is it going to keep growing uncontrollably?
It is just the trilogy. And if my editor comes back and asks for one more book, I have told him I'm going to push him into a canal. Because he just can't. I don't like the story's over. I ended it.
That's not how magic works, Freemy.
Oh, I know. So yeah, I don't know if JR's read all three books, but because I thought it was supposed to be a duology, I closed a lot of doors pretty hard at the end of the second book and locked them. JR's nodding, he can confirm.
Oh, no.
And then a couple months before the second book was supposed to be published, my editor emailed me and my agent with this cheery, like, so what are we thinking of as a title for the third book? Like, what are we? What?
Oh, it is. So that is the best way to sell a book, though. So good.
The time to tell me there was going to be a third book was when we were still in edits for the second book, which was months before. Anyways, we came up with something and he took it to acquisitions and they said, yay. And they bought it. And I sat there for like a month, not moving with my hands on the keyboard, like, what am I going to do?
Yeah, I love books that you feel that you just feel like they put everything on the page in book one. And then you're reading book two and you're like, oh, there was more. And you're like, yeah, there's no way to do more. And they still and do I more. Mean, that's amazing.
I would like to say, yes, like cursed. When you are reading book one, you don't feel like there will be a sequel.
And then, going to be a sequel.
Right. And then when you read book two, you're sort of like, well, there obviously can't be a sequel.
No, I mean, there's an incident at the end of book two.
Yeah. And yet I think you do a great job of, and I want to be clear here, right? It's like, it's not that you don't want to spend more time with these characters or in this world. It's just like the story feels finished and the story feels done.
Yeah.
Massive stakes. That you don't cheat with, which is something I think that happens so often in trilogies, right? Something gets dangled, and then there's like even when it's good sleight of hand, right? There's like narrative sleight of hand that like pulls you back from the edge, mm-hmm. and instead you just throw us off the edge,
There was some throwing at the end of the second book. Yeah, I can't imagine that there would be a fourth book sort of chronologically, but I could almost see like spin-off stories. Like I'm sure Johnny has some explaining to do about the super collider incident, in which he literally collided a super collider with another super collider underground and was prosecuted. And there was a little kerfuffle because there was a lot of damage. I'm sure she would love to explain that. You know, so I could see almost like novellas or short stories or something like that, but I couldn't see like a fourth book that is like part of a series, you know?
Hmm.
And again, if my editor shows up to do that, there's going to be violence. And he knows how I feel about this, so if he's listening to it later, David, don't say I didn't warn you.
I want to circle back a little bit because I feel like we have downplayed how much cosmic horror is in these books, and it's just there's so much and it's so great. And that is not I don't think that's a sandbox that's easy to play in. So I'm even more impressed that you were like, oh, yeah, I wasn't really thinking about it as a horror book. And, you know, and yet even still. So when you set out to now write this second book that you didn't know you would be writing at that point, were you thinking I'm doing cosmic horror, or were you really hanging out with the kids? Like what?
Yeah. The second one, I think I was a little more because the first one had gotten so firmly pigeonholed and you know, rightfully so in cosmic horror, but it was a term I wasn't super duper familiar with. Again, for some reason, two science degrees did not leave me with a whole lot of like writing education.
Weird. And
yeah, it's so weird. So they didn't want us like reading Beowulf in organic chemistry.
What?
And I'm sure it's shocking. But how can you clone a Grendel?
Exactly. That's why we get mad scientists. They don't know our stories.
Exactly. They don't have that. They don't have the same area of critical thinking. They have critical thinking about other things.
That's right.
But yeah, very much kind of. So I was like, okay, well, I better do some reading up on cosmic horror because it's starting to come up in interviews and it's starting to come up in like panels and stuff. And again, in Worldcon 2019, when the book hadn't even been published yet, I got put on a cosmic horror panel. So I was frantically Amazing. Researching what it was. It was kind of like, I had a book published last September, The Annual Migration of Clouds, and marketing used the word hope punk in the, in like the description, in the blurb on the website. So I didn't read that. I didn't look at the blurb. And somebody like a couple weeks later brought up the term in an interview and I was like, hope punk, yeah. Can you just hold on 1 second? Because I think my camera's about to freeze. So I was like, Google it because I'm very subtle that way. And I got back and I was like, yes, hope punk.
Yes, exactly.
Yes, exactly. Because what is science for if not being able to research things very, very quickly to avoid, you know, humiliation or embarrassment or world-ending cataclysms? And so I lean into it a little more with the second one because like you said, it's a sandbox. And the sandbox already has a bunch of toys scattered around in it. And so I was kind of digging some of those up, looking for patterns that were already in cosmic horror stories and seeing if I wanted to kind of, you know, like recycle them or grab them and kind of twist them. Or, I mean, it's already enough of a twist that it's, you know, a girl who is one of the main characters, that the girl is a scientist, that Nick is a person of color, all things that, you know, the older cosmic horror stories very much were not about.
Yep.
And also that they're young people. The older stories are all, they're about established people. A lot of them are about, you know, professors or teachers or, you know, definitely people with some life experience under their belt, instead of Nick being like, oh my God, I've got a fake passport and I'm leaving the country for the first time. I'm going to get arrested. He does not get arrested. He gets arrested later.
Wow. Wow. Okay. And we have kind of also you've made multiple sort of comments about it, but you're a scientist in your day job. Is that right?
Yeah.
So tell us a little bit about that.
What can I say without getting fired? I guess I'm on the public directory, but no, I'm a reclamation and remediation policy specialist.
Oh, see, so we don't even know what that means. You're fine.
Okay. cleaning up contaminated sites.
Oh, wow.
And sites that have been impacted by human activities. So that's my second degree. And it's an interesting job. Environmental policy is a stressful place to be. I guess I've been at this now for what, 8 going on 9 years. I've also worked in heavy industry. I've also worked in consulting and research. And After my first degree, which was molecular genetics, I worked in a combined hepatitis and cancer lab. And I worked for Agriculture Agri-Food Canada making Franken canola, which was great. And I called it Franken canola. And my supervisor was like, don't call it that. I'm like, well, it is. It's an abomination. She's like, it is an abomination. But don't hurt its feelings.
Oh, no. It sounds like you were living in a cosmic horror story right there.
Little bit. But yeah, I've definitely been on all the various sides of many aspects of science. And I don't know that the science itself often informs my fiction, in as much as I'm generally not necessarily writing about like Superfund sites or gravel pits. But like the scientific process kind of does, like in terms of being able to research things quickly and to find connections between things and to kind of organize what I found and to smoosh things together that might not always go together. But if you can find a narrative reason to do it, you kind of can. That was kind of how I approached things like the, you know, all the non-human species in the third book. There's a lot of people there that aren't what you'd call people.
And, are they canola?
And I had a lot of fun with that.
They're not canola.
There's some implied canola.
Oh, there is some. Okay, there is some canola action. Okay, good.
I was actually in a punk band in college called Implied Canola.
So. Oh, excellent. Yeah, I was going to say, well, obviously I can't steal that now for the name of my next, like, ska band, but...
Oh, no. Jared.
No, I was just lying, so...
Jared would be thrilled if that showed up in one of your books.
Oh, join my ska band.
Wait, so, do you actually have a ska band?
I actually do not have a ska band. I cannot even play the spoons.
Oh, spoons are not necessary for ska. You know, like a trumpet or something.
I always just say ska because it sounds funny. I actually can't play anything. I have no musical talent.
When I was in college, ska was kind of at its height. And one year they had a really big band at the time in California come to play some ska at our homecoming. And it was Skank and Pickle. They were.
That's such a good name.
Yeah, they're pretty good.
Did you skank at homecoming, Matt?
Of course, man. I went right in the mosh pit. Okay. Yeah. I got my toenail kicked off because I was wearing flip-flops.
And a useful lesson was learned by us all.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
Yeah. I don't think that would have happened at any of our schools because, again, the other funny thing about all these books is that they initially, the very first book, I thought for a couple of, I don't know, months or something, that it was going to be straight up like, the bad guy is going to be the devil. As in, guess who just came out of 12 years of Catholic school and thought the devil was a bad guy? And then I started doing some reading. I'm like, oh, no, he's small potatoes. I can do better.
Preemie, have you read...
Somewhere the devil is just like...
When you were reading your cosmic horror stuff, did you read Brian Lumley's Titus Crowe books at all?
No, I didn't.
So
the name rings a bell, though, because
Brian Lumley's Catholic, and his cosmic horror is very much kind of Catholic-themed. The first one called, I think, The Burrowers Beneath. It's pretty good. It's a lot of fun. Mm-hmm. Yours sounds more fun, I'll be honest. But yeah, it's...
Catholicism itself, I don't know. They in school, they didn't really emphasize like the fun parts of it, like the saints and stuff. it was very much just like the, you know, well, don't do the deed before marriage, or you'll definitely get AIDS and die.
Oh,
we're like,
yeah.
Is there anything else you've been meaning to tell us? And they're like,
yeah, no, there's...
No, that's about it.
It's all body horror.
And don't use protection. Yeah. Oh, okay, guys. So did you need like the full 12 years for that? And they're like,
yeah,
absolutely. We did.
It's the most fertile years of your life that we've had.
It's the most fertile years of your life. Yeah. And then
just
later
look
on,
at the, what's the animal you talked about at the beginning?
Right. Horror. Sorry. Yeah.
Yeah. What was the name of that cute little animal?
The echidna or whatever.
Yeah, just send those little things to Catholic school. They'll be fine.
Look at those things. Do you want to end up like them?
And they don't use protection either. But they have to make their deaths worth something. I don't know.
That's right.
Poor little guys.
Heroes. Little heroes.
Little heroes.
I feel bad for the one that puts in all that work and doesn't get a chick.
Yeah. I feel sorry for the scientists studying them. Like,
oh, yeah.
I don't know. I feel sorry for several varieties of scientists, myself included.
It's a hard job, especially in the current world atmosphere.
Yeah, it's true.
Yeah.
So, Preemie, before we wrap up, I know folks are going to want to follow your work online, where do you like to direct us? I know you hang out on Twitter. You're a fun Twitter follow. Where else do you like people to follow you?
I do hang out on Twitter a lot. My handle's at Primisaurus. And I try to keep my website relatively up to date with short fiction and you know, appearances and interviews and stuff, which is just my name, PrimiMohammed.com. And I'm occasionally on Instagram, but I keep forgetting that it exists because I don't really like Instagram. Same. Like, it's okay. I don't know. Like, I'm part of me is like, I think I might literally just be too old for Instagram. I think literally I just aged out of the ideal age group, whatever that is. Like, I'm 40 years old. I can't cope. Like, and don't try to get me to sign up for TikTok either. And also, you kids, get off my lawn.
My nephew is TikTok famous. He,
is he?
He plays music on a keyboard that is shaped like a cat, and all the keys make meowing sounds. And so he literally like plays video game themes, and all you see is his hands playing on this cat. And he has thousands and thousands of followers. They love him. It's hilarious.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
It's kind of a TikTok mirror. Also, I recognize the instrument because my best friend apparently got up at his sister's wedding, and I wasn't able to make it because of the plague. Got up at his sister's wedding, and instead of giving a speech, played a song on that instrument.
Amazing.
Family reaction was mixed. I think it was the best way to do it. His sister was delighted.
Well, that's what matters.
But, and that's what matters, yeah.
Oh, boy.
Well, Premium, anyway. Before you go, we'd love for you to join us in our closing ritual, which is we each share something from pop culture that's fascinating us. And it can be new pop culture, old pop culture, doesn't matter, yeah. Just like something you want to throw out. So we'll let you go last since we're springing it on you. But Matt, what's fascinating you this week?
I don't know if you've seen the TV show Hacks. It's on HBO. It is great. I love it. Second season is coming out now. I think the first 6 episodes or something are out. It's about a 25-year-old writer in Hollywood who keeps burning every bridge because she's terrible and can't keep her mouth shut. And so she's burning every relationship. She's destroying every chance that's put in front of her. And what ends up happening is in a last-ditch effort to get her a job, her manager or agent hooks her up with this kind of failing Las Vegas comedian who's been around forever, but she's incredibly toxic. But she wants to kind of freshen up her act. And they put these two women together, and it's so toxic and destructive and hilarious. And they, you know, it's as you would expect, it's kind of about them trying to find a way to help each other become better while being really similar to each other. So it's really, really funny and surprisingly heartfelt. And I just love it. So that's called Hacks. It's on, and the acting's amazing. So good. It's on HBO.
That sounds great.
It's really good. Yeah.
I saw with my wife and our friend Moxie the new Alex Garland film, Men.
Uh-oh.
Which
that
is...
That's so scary, dude. Is it scary?
Oh, yeah.
Okay, so we can't watch it then.
Wow. We have to go to JR's house to watch it.
Yeah.
It's really traumatizing.
Oh, no. I don't want to watch it then.
And I... Basically, the takeaway from the movie is patriarchy is bad.
Oh.
So I was a little frustrated because I wanted it to have something more interesting to say. It delivered a very banal message in a very
horrific,
compelling and horrific and traumatizing way. but I honestly was wishing that we had a female director telling the story, because I just think it probably would have actually been a lot more interesting.
You said it was Alex Garland?
Yeah, so he did Ex Machina, he did Devs, he did...
Ex Machina is kind of like...
Annihilation.
Sketchy on that whole topic, it seems like. That's interesting.
Yeah, I mean, it's also got a lot of Garden of Eden references, which Ex Machina did as well. Huh. So I think Alex Garland is obsessed with Garden of Eden, at least the mythology and the imagery of it.
Did he go to Catholic school, Jer?
Did he also go to Catholic school?
I don't know. Maybe.
Sounds like.
So anyway, I liked it.
We should tweet him and ask.
We should. I would love that. I would love to interview him about that. Hear that, Alex Premi. We'll come back on as a co-host. Yeah. Volunteering her.
I'll even watch Men.
Yeah, they'll go.
I will not.
I'll live tweet it for Premi. Actually,
both of the women that I saw it with basically said it made them feel a lot of things that they already have to feel as a woman in society.
Oh.
So like it just wasn't, it was horrifying, but not in a way that was like escapist and fun. It was more like, again, it seems like you're saying it sucks to be a woman in a patriarchal world.
Like creepy man is following women, you in the parking lot, like that kind of feeling.
Yeah, that's like the shallow end of the pool.
Oh, that's the intro.
Movie. yeah. So, yeah. So again, right. Like I don't,
Creamy doesn't
I don't
even
know
want
that
to hear about this movie.
Yeah. Well, you could,
text me a summary later that might not scare me.
the two women that I went with did not find it to be an overall profitable film going experience.
Oh, interesting.
And I think.
But you've been thinking about it a lot, it sounds like. So it's been.
I have.
Fascinating.
Because I was really struck by a lot of it. And I think that the imagery was. It will be one of those movies that will be talked about for a long time. But I just think ultimately it's going to end up having been something that was a B when it could have been an A. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So anyway, Men, Alex Garland in theaters now. Don't go see it unless you want to be scared. Premi, what about you?
Oh, God. Yeah. I don't have any streaming services and I never watch TV or movies because I'm not cool. And also, I have like zero attention span. I can barely watch a GIF all the way through. Anyways, after John Le Carré died, I actually started reading his books in chronological order of publication.
Really?
And I was like, well, how interesting can this possibly be? First of all, for any genre, he is a very good writer. I thought they were going to be kind of, you know, pulpy thrillers.
Yeah.
They're not. They're very accomplished. A Perfect Spy is some of the finest like literary writing I can think of. Not that I'm able to emulate any of this, obviously, not that I could ever write a spy novel, but I'm also kind of, as a result of that, like spinning off, I just finished The Russia House. I'm starting to read the Secret Pilgrim. We didn't really learn a whole lot about the Cold War in school. Like they literally just kind of skipped a whole bunch of stuff. And I was even hazy on how did the end of World War II literally lead into the Cold War? Like what exactly happened there?
Interesting.
So now I'm basically self-educating on all that, you know, how it started and like the Hungarian Students' Revolution, which is horrifying and sad. And like the basis of the Korean War and the Vietnam War and the history of American intervention in, you know, the Middle East and in South America and that kind of thing. And the thing about the books is none of this is mentioned. Early mentioned like very obliquely with like a single sentence or half a sentence. Like somebody will be like, yeah, well, you know, we'd better go. We don't want a repeat of what happened in Cuba. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, what happened in Cuba? So then I have to go. It's pointing out all the gaps in my education, but it's also very, very satisfying reading. I'm enjoying it so much. And I'm just annoyed that like, I know more about like the history of ancient Celtic languages in pre-Roman Britain than I do about the Cold War, which just happened, which ended when I was in like grade 7 or something.
Wow.
If my memory serves, it ended when Rocky went to Russia and fought Dolph Lundgren, right? That's
And we didn't get to watch the movie in school, so it's very unfair.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I'm really enjoying it. It's
that's really cool.
And also kind of the escapism of it also, because as I'm reading, I'm like, oh, this could definitively never happen to me. So I will just dive right in and pretend to be someone else.
That's amazing.
That's awesome. All right, folks. Well, this has been episode number 326. Our guest has been Premi Mohammed. She has 6 books out. 3 of them are they're called the Beneath the Rising series, which is the title of the first book. I keep calling them the Void series, but Beneath the Rising series.
I think we should call them the Void series.
I mean, they're great.
My editor was saying the other day, he's like, what are we going to call this? I'm like, you're the editor! Pick something! So I think on the website, it's just called The Beneath the Rising
Premium. Series. Sorry. I just feel like the way you're treating your editor, he deserves a fourth book. If you're out there listening.
Deserve David, a fourth book. David, go do your job. Go kill some commas or something so I can step them.
Premi, again, thank you so much for being on. It has been an absolute delight. And
thank you so much for inviting me.
Folks, make sure you reach out, find Premi on Twitter, Premiosaurus, visit her website. Make sure you pick up the books because I need someone to talk about them with.
One of them just won a Nebula last week.
What? Hey, congratulations. Premi,
congratulations. That's huge.
Yeah, that was pretty exciting. And I was eating supper because I assumed one of the other books was going to win. So they cut to me and I was like, literally like taking bacon out of my mouth so that I can give my speech because dignity, I've never heard of it.
Amazing.
I mean, I know how to spell it approximately. My editor would disagree, but yeah, go buy And What Can We Offer You Tonight? It just went a Nebula.
Amazing. Congratulations.
Yeah.
I'm going to go buy it right now.
Again, Premi, thank you so much. Congrats on the award. And we'll be back next week with another great episode. Until then, take care of each other out there. Be careful what you wish for and stay away from any eldritch tentacles.